60 feet, not 6,000, not 600. 60 feet above the surface of a black reservoir, in the dark of a German night, at 230 miles per hour. In a four-engine bomber that weighs over 60,000 pounds. Holding that altitude so precisely that two spotlights mounted beneath the aircraft have to converge into a perfect figure eight on the water below, because that is the only altimeter that works at those speeds at that height, in that darkness. That is what they asked those crews to do. I'm Taildragger, and you're listening to The Hangar on Radio Hangar. Tonight, we're talking about one of the most audacious precision bombing missions in aviation history, the night the Royal Air Force went looking for dams. May 16, 1943. Germany is deep into its war. The industrial heart of the Third Reich pumps through the Ruhr Valley in western Germany. A dense tangle of steel mills, coal mines, armament factories and chemical plants that produce the raw materials of Nazi military power. And those factories run on electricity and water from three great dams, the Möhne, the Eder, and the Sorb. The British had wanted to destroy those dams for years. A dam without water is just a concrete wall. A breach dam is a catastrophe. Flooding hundreds of square miles of valley, collapsing roads and rail lines, destroying the industrial water supply those Ruhr factories desperately needed. The problem was getting through. Conventional bombs dropped from altitude simply don't work on a dam. A dam is curved and thick and angled. A bomb has to hit nearly dead on to do any structural damage, and from 20,000 feet that's essentially impossible with the technology of 1943. And the Germans knew their dams were valuable. They had strung torpedo nets across the reservoirs, 60 feet below the waterline, to stop exactly the kind of underwater attack the British were contemplating. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com. Aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight, first solo, private pilot, instrument rating, all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story. Check them out at AviationSoul.com. Now here's where it gets interesting. Barnes Wallace was a British aeronautical engineer who had already designed the Wellington bomber, which is a pretty solid resume item on its own. But his mind worked in unusual directions. He had been studying the problem of the Ruhr dams since before the war, and somewhere around 1941, he had an idea that must have sounded absolutely insane the first time he said it out loud. What if you could make a bomb skip? Think about skipping a stone across a lake. You throw it at the right angle with the right backspin and it bounces along the surface, losing a little energy with each contact until it finally sinks. Wallace saw the physics in that motion. If you could spin a mine backwards, drop it from the right height at the right speed, release it at the right distance from the dam face, it would skip across the surface of the reservoir. It would clear the torpedo nets entirely. It would reach the dam wall, and because of that backspin, it would run down the face of the dam and detonate at depth, directly against the concrete. The water would do the rest. Water doesn't compress. An explosion at depth against a dam wall transmits its full force directly into the structure. What it does is shake the dam apart from the inside. Wallace called his device upkeep. The press would later call it the bouncing bomb. It took him 2 years to prove it would work. There were experiments with marbles in a bathtub. There were scale model tests. There were full-scale drops over the English Channel. There were long arguments with skeptical Air Ministry officials who didn't want to hear about spinning cylindrical mines dropped from 60 feet at 240 miles per hour. But Wallace had data, and eventually the data won. By spring of 1943, upkeep was approved for operational use, which meant the Royal Air Force now had a weapon that had never been used in combat before, requiring a set of delivery conditions so precise that no existing training program had ever attempted to teach them. They needed a special unit. Wing Commander Guy Gibson was 24 years old and had already flown over 170 operations. If you're counting at home, that is about 150 more than most people survive. Decorated, experienced, and known for pushing himself and his crews hard. He was exactly what Air Chief Marshal Arthur Harris needed for what was about to become one of the most dangerous assignments in Bomber Command. Gibson was ordered to form a new squadron, designated 617 Squadron. He had 6 weeks. He was told almost nothing about the mission. He recruited what he considered the best crews in Bomber Command, pilots who had demonstrated low-level flying skill, steady nerves, and the kind of judgment that doesn't evaporate when the searchlights come on. The aircraft was the Avro Lancaster, a big, powerful four-engine heavy bomber that Bomber Command had come to trust deeply by this point in the war, but the Lancaster had to be substantially modified for this mission. The bomb bay doors came off entirely to accommodate the cylindrical shape of upkeep. A belt drive motor was installed to spin the mine up to 500 revolutions per minute before release. The ventral gun turret was removed to save weight. and those spotlights were mounted at angles beneath the nose and tail, wired to converge at exactly 60 feet, because there was no other reliable way to hold that altitude in the dark over a reservoir. The training program was unlike anything Bomber Command had ever run. For 6 weeks, 617 Squadron practiced low-level flying over reservoirs in Britain. They flew at dusk and through the night. They studied the approach angles and drilled the timing. They flew cross-country at 100 feet, then 50 feet, then lower still. The air at that altitude has a different character. You feel the terrain in the aircraft. Every ridge and tree line registers in the seat of your pants before your eyes ever process it. The crews were building a physical vocabulary, learning what 60 feet looks like and feels like and smells like when the damp air off a reservoir is washing past your cockpit at 200 miles per hour. They lost one aircraft and crew in training. Nobody talked about it. The mission was too important and too secret for grief to have anywhere to land. On the night of May 16th, Gibson briefed his crews for the first time on the actual target. He launched 19 Avro Lancasters in three waves. The first wave of 9 aircraft would attack the Moni Dam, then proceed to the Eater if bombs remained. A second wave of 5 aircraft would take a different route across the North Sea, flying in from the south to attack the Sorp Dam. A third wave of 5 would be held in reserve to follow up wherever the primary waves needed reinforcement. They flew at low level all the way in, 60 to 100 feet, below radar. Below the effective range of most searchlights, below the heavy flak that would have torn them apart at altitude. At that height, at that speed, the landscape blurs underneath you. A power line across a valley is a wall you are suddenly inside of before you see it. A church steeple is a mortal threat. Trees on a hillside are something you thread through, not over. The pilots were reading the terrain ahead in darkness, relying on moonlight and instinct and the muscle memory of 6 weeks of drilling, and they were doing it in a 60,000-pound aircraft. While enemy gunners were tracking them, they took losses going in. 2 aircraft were hit by flak before reaching any target. 1 Lancaster clipped a power line at low level and shed an antenna and pressed on anyway. The second wave, taking the longer southern route to the Sorp, was badly disrupted, losing 2 aircraft to flak and having others abort due to damage. Only 1 Lancaster from that entire second wave reached the Sorp that night. Gibson arrived over the Moni Reservoir shortly after midnight. The scene below him must have looked almost peaceful. The surface of the water caught the moonlight. The great curved wall of the Moni Dam stood solid across the valley, nearly 40 meters high, holding back 240 million tons of water that the Ruhr Valley had trusted it with for over 30 years. 617 Squadron began its attack runs. The approach was demanding in ways that are hard to fully communicate if you haven't flown a precise low-level instrument profile in the dark. The Lancaster had to line up on 2 towers at either end of the dam face, holding a precise compass heading. The pilot had to hold 60 feet, confirmed by those converging spotlights on the reservoir below. The bombardier used a simple wooden triangular sight, handmade from plans drawn up specifically for this mission, to judge the exact distance to the dam face and call the release. The mine had to be spinning at full speed. It had to be released at the right moment, at the right height, at the right speed. Every variable had to land within a narrow band simultaneously. And underneath the aircraft, the flak guns ringing the dam were firing. Gibson made the first run himself. He dropped upkeep, it skipped across the reservoir, reached the dam face, sank, and detonated. The dam shook, a column of water rose into the air. But the dam held, he brought in the next aircraft, same result. The dam shook, and the water rose, and the structure stood. One by one, the Lancasters made their runs. Gibson flew alongside the attacking aircraft each time, his radio alive, drawing flak fire toward himself to give the bomb-dropping crews a cleaner run. He talked each crew in. After the third bomb, there was no breach. After the fourth, still nothing. One Lancaster was shot up badly on its approach and barely made it out of the valley. The fifth bomb hit the dam differently. The explosion lifted a column of water so high that Gibson, circling nearby, initially couldn't tell if the dam had held. Then through the spray, he saw it. The face of the Moni Dam had cracked, and then it gave way completely. Gibson would later say the dam seemed to simply lift itself out of the ground. The water didn't flow through the breach, it erupted. A wall of water, moving at terrifying speed, poured into the Ruhr Valley below. 240 million tons of water that had been stored peacefully behind that wall for 3 decades was now loose on the valley floor, moving fast, carrying everything with it. Gibson took stock of his remaining bombs. 3 aircraft still had theirs. He led them to the Eater Dam. The Eater was harder to attack than the Moni. The reservoir sat in a narrow valley surrounded by hills, and the approach required a steep diving descent through a gap in the ridgeline, leveling off at 60 feet, making the bomb run, then pulling up sharply to clear the hillside on the far side. One pilot made 6 separate approach attempts before he was satisfied he had the angle right. The crews called it the most demanding flying any of them had ever done. The Eater had no flak guns defending it because the Germans hadn't believed anyone could ever get a usable attack run in that terrain. They were wrong. 2 upkeep bombs hit off target. The 3rd hit perfectly. The Eater dam breached by the time 617 Squadron turned for home in the early hours of May 17th. 2 of the 3 primary targets were gone. The SORP was struck once, but not breached, its earthen construction more resistant to the bouncing bomb than the concrete masonry of the Moni and Eater. 8 of the 19 Lancasters did not come back. 53 aircrew were killed. 3 were taken prisoner. The flooding in the valley was immense. Towns were inundated, factories were swamped, roads and bridges were washed out. The power and water infrastructure that fed Ruhr industry was severely disrupted. Historians still debate the long-term strategic impact, because Germany repaired the dams faster than British planners had hoped, bringing in thousands of workers to restore them before the end of the year. But the immediate damage was real and substantial, and the effect on German morale and Allied confidence was impossible to ignore. Guy Gibson was awarded the Victoria Cross, the highest honor the Commonwealth could bestow. Nobody who knew what he had done that night argued about it. 617 Squadron never went away after the dams raid. They stayed together as a precision strike unit for the rest of the war, taking on targets that required something beyond standard bomber command tactics. They used the Tallboy and Grand Slam deep penetration bombs that Wallace designed in the years after upkeep, weapons that could burrow into reinforced concrete before detonating. They sank the German battleship Tirpitz in a Norwegian fjord, dropping Tallboys from high altitude until the great ship rolled over and capsized. They collapsed submarine pens, broke viaducts, destroyed rail tunnels across occupied Europe. They became what the Royal Air Force quietly called its precision instrument, but what pulls me back to the dams raid, every time I think about it, is the specificity of the flying itself. These crews weren't just brave. They were precise. They had built a skill to an edge so sharp it barely existed. 60 feet, 230 miles per hour, in the dark, in combat, through flak. And then executing a release sequence with a homemade wooden sight that gave them exactly 1 chance per run. Aviation teaches you that precision is a discipline, not a gift. You don't show up and just fly 60 feet at night over water. You practice it until it's in your hands, until the altitude holds itself, until your eye knows what 60 feet looks like when the spotlights converge below you and the reservoir is rushing past in the moonlight. Those crews built that discipline in 6 weeks. Then they went and used it against a mountain of concrete and steel holding back 240 million tons of water. And they broke it. Much of tonight's history draws on the research of Paul Brickhill and his account The Dam Busters and the Royal Air Force Museum's record of 617 Squadron. More at radiohanger.com, I'm Taildragger. Watch your altitude. See you next time.